Hi, this is Peter Jackson, and welcome to Bums on Seats. I love saying that. I'm going to say it again. Bums on Seats.
Excuse me. The police are here. They asked for you.
Tell them I'll be right down.
I am not joking now. You are the last straw that breaks my camel's back. You bring havoc and chaos to everyone, but why to me? Why me? Why? Why?
Because you look cute in your pajamas, Steve.
Do you know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
So how about it, honey? Just for a little while. Let old Trixie sit up front.
Governor Tuck, I recognized your foul stench when I was brought on board.
Charming to the last.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, and thanks to the wonders of the internet across the world as well. Welcome to Bums on Seats, the film show that today's gone full Toy Story. All the buzz on the latest new releases, the other famous Woody, a selection of slinky reviewers, and probably a slice or two of ham from me. My name is Mark Liversidge, or Mr. Pricklepants, as I'm sometimes known. And joining me on the show today are Laura Poole.
Afternoon.
And Dave Riley.
Hello.
With the Ozzy Osbourne joining us later. Today's show truly captures the depth and breadth of modern cinema. War opens an opportunity for equality in the drama their finest. Jim Broadbent's past comes back to haunt him in the sense of an ending. Vin Diesel sells out his extended family in massive car chase soap opera Fast and Furious 8. And we have, as Wikipedia temptingly puts it, the erotic psychological thrill of The Handmaiden. Plus we talked to film academic Rebecca Harrison on the very nearly forgotten history of the women who worked as cinema projectionists during the Second World War. And we preview tomorrow's exciting special Arts Picture House screening of Lost in London, with its star and director Woody Harrelson in attendance. So much to come, but we start by raising the morale of a nation.
Welcome to the Ministry of Information Film Division.
Mr. Churchill is persuaded that film can show that this is a war America should be fighting.
If we're to capture the public imagination and their trust, we need a story to inspire a nation.
Dunkirk, the evacuation of troops trapped by the German advance.
It's very good.
I just wonder if it mightn't pack a little more punch.
Dunkirk, the miracle that put the fire back in all our bellies.
Mrs. Cole, we'll need someone to write the slop.
Slop?
Girl talk. Women's dialogue.
I thought it was a secretarial post.
Well, for God's sake, keep that to yourself.
I just can't do this anymore.
The work's good. None of them could have done any better.
You and me, given opportunities only because young men are gone. But to turn our back on those opportunities, wouldn't that be giving death dominion over life?
If all of this stopped, I'd miss it.
Over the last few years, Danish filmmaker Lone Scherfig has settled on observing the shadowy corners of British society, from the seedy bedsits of an education to the secret societies of the Riot Club and the hidden heroism of her new film, Their Finest. Based on the book by Lisa Evans, Their Finest stars Gemma Arterton as Catherine Cole, a journalist who is one of many women drafted in to replace the men conscripted to fight the Second World War. She ends up as a screenwriter in the UK film industry, patronisingly asked to provide a feminine touch to thinly written B-movies. But the War Office want more from cinema, and Catherine and her fellow filmmakers are tasked with creating patriotic blockbusters to lift the spirits of a country at war. Laura, Their Finest is a different kind of war movie, offering a perspective from home rather than the battlefront. So does it actually offer anything new?
A chance for Gemma Arterton to show she can act.
Which is always appreciated. I do think she's one of the more underrated actresses.
I think Prince of Serbia ruined it for her slightly, but she's finally back there.
Slight connection, Prince of Persia. Moving on.
Oh,
sorry.
Persia.
Pedant.
Oh, the wrong one. No, but it's a really
I want to see Prince of Serbia, though. That sounds amazing. Sorry.
Probably wouldn't be that different.
No.
It is a great film for a different perspective on it. And I love that it's not depressing, but it still touches on the depressing moments with the Blitz scenes. And it's humorous as well as then being more moving towards the end. And it's nice to see her in that role and fight the male-dominated world of, we can't pay you as much as the men, of course. But it put a new shine on it for me.
I have to say that watching the trailer, Dave, it did seem a little bit cliched. I don't know if the trailer does the best job necessarily of selling the film. How much of that cliché translates into the film?
Well, I think I maybe found it a bit too cliched at times. It certainly didn't help that I seem to have ended up in a showing with what I can only describe as the entirety of the Blue Rinse Brigade. And they seemed to be laughing at all of the jokes I was expecting them to laugh at, which disappointed me that they were missing moments of the more subtle humour. I mean, Bill Nye just had to walk on the screen and they were cheering, which was nice, actually. It's good to be in a cinema that involved with someone, people watching the film.
I have to confess, I cheer whenever Bill Nye comes on screen as well, but that's just a personal thing.
I do, but I keep it internally because I don't want to disturb the experience for everyone else, you know, until he says a joke that's funny and then I allow myself to laugh out loud. I mean, it was a tricky film for me because I felt like it was trying to juggle too many different genres at the same time because, of course, it is set during the war. You know, terrible things happened at home as well as abroad. But the way it kept introducing them, it seemed a little over the top at times, which is horrible to say. But it just kind of dragged me out of the moment, which I thought it was actually doing quite well to pull me into in the first place.
Well, I was racking my brains trying to think of another example of a war movie that's set so prominently away from the battlefield, and I got as far as Dad's Army, and that was about as far as it went. Is there a... not quite an element of Dad's Arminess to this, but actually, do we feel a bit detached from the conflict by having this set at home?
Yeah, I would say so. They touch upon it all, but I mean, the whole point is they're making a propaganda film. It's got to not show that the war was a horrible, awful time. So,
And is it possible to do that without actually bringing that perspective in? Because we get one character who is the American who comes into this, of course, who's actually seen battle, but we never really get any sense of the experience of war that he's actually had within the film.
No, the closest it comes to it is when they mention every now and again there'll be a quiet scene where someone has lost someone who's... I know one of the sadder moments is one of the producers, you find out that he's lost his grandson, but it's because he was hit by a bus while he was on leave, and it's the tragedy striking at home even more so because he was removed from the conflict. I mean, I can't think of many other movies that look at the home front quite well without bringing conflict into it. There's Went the Day Well, but of course that turns into a war movie. So as for just examining things, I'm not entirely sure. Was Land Girls a film or was that a TV series?
No, that was a film with Sienna Miller.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Well, that's put my film noise to shame already, so that's a good start. I think let's talk about Gemma Arterton a bit more because she has had a bit of a rough ride sometimes in films, and this gives her an opportunity to shine with maybe a slightly dodgy Welsh accent. Is that fair to say?
Very dodgy Welsh accent.
Very dodgy Welsh accent. But, you know, I think obviously leading female roles to be applauded in film. Do we think she gets the opportunity to truly shine in this?
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, and now I'll call the film the proper name of Prince of Persia, she hasn't had the best time with films. And Nancy Drew, it probably wasn't even called that either, with Luke Evans.
That's really put my film knowledge to shame.
Oh, okay, I will move on from that. I'm now showing everybody up. No, but she has had a chance to. And yes, she still plays the beautiful woman, but she gets a chance to fight for it a bit more, really, in this role. And I know she's had a lot of success in the West End recently.
Yes, with The Maid in Dagenham, of course.
Yeah, of course. So we might not have seen her as much in cinema. And I just hope this is the start of her getting some better roles.
I mean, the one thing that takes me back is, if either you saw The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which was nearly 10 years ago now, which is also with Eddie Marsan in, which is a role where she's abducted and it's quite a ferocious role. And it just seems that there don't appear to be these opportunities in British film for those kind of roles anymore. Why do we think that is? Why are our best actresses not getting the opportunity to shine? You know, we're seeing a film here that's about, you know, the male domination of something in the 40s, and here we are 70 years later. Has the film industry moved on enough?
Probably not. I mean, I blame the fact that we're all doing reviews here instead of being casting directors. That probably doesn't help at all. I'd like to think we've got a wide enough open mind, but this is the job we're in as opposed to the job that needs doing, perhaps. And it's Tamara Drew. That's the other film.
Well done, Dave, not Nancy Drew. She's a detective.
Dave gets all the film Witcher brownie points today. I was also interested in the way that Lona Scherfig approached the film. There seems to me a real sense of pathos at certain points, but also there's a melancholy in this, which actually sort of runs throughout the whole film as well. You know, I think about things like An Education, which, you know, all the bedsit shots are this murky brown, and, you know, that fits in very well with the wartime shots. You know, wartime films almost seem by default shot in grey and brown and no other colours because they were all rations during the war. You know, is there enough? There's obviously a lot of lightness, particularly with the relationship between Gemma Arterton and Sam Claflin. Does the film balance that lightness and the more darker moments successfully?
I think it does. Again, I found at times it spilt the balance, as it were, and it threw me out of the film a bit when that did happen. But in terms of mixing in, I mean, that is almost what the Blitz spirit is defined as, is that, you know, it's a terrible time, but we find the light in the darkness and we keep going along. And there is always an undertone throughout the film. You know, just around the corner, something terrible could happen to one or all of these characters. You know, they could all be in the studio and it gets hit by a bomb because there's a lost bomber in the middle of the day, something like that. But the balance, it's maintained throughout. I don't know if at the times of the most dramatic impact, I don't think it held it enough there for me. And that was my only kind of real problem with the film, is that it pushed me out of it again.
In what sense? Is not capturing the drama enough, do you feel?
Again, this is the bit where I felt it went maybe too over the top, and I was like, you know, there's a couple of scenes where it's like, so something bad has happened and everyone's been talking about it and it's the typical thing that's happened, and then they seem to add in a "and just to make it worse" moment, and that was the bit that kind of ruined it for me. Again, because it's based on the book, I haven't read the book in this instance, so I need to go back and try and, you know, compare the two and think, well, is this something that was prevalent throughout the book as well and they've just translated it to the film, or is it a stylistic decision they've made on their own which maybe doesn't quite work as well?
I have to hold my hand and confess that I actually didn't dislike Me Before You. We're really struggling with our film titles this morning. The romantic comedy, sort of, which turned into a romantic drama, which had Emilia Clarke and Sam Claflin in last year. It was probably his biggest role outside of The Hunger Games. So again, he's in a sort of romantic relationship here, but a very unusual one. He's a very stiff upper lipped, tight character, and, you know, it's not an obvious relationship because we start the film with Gemma Arterton's character being married. So, you know, it's just a working place relationship. A lot of the dynamic between Sam Claflin and Gemma Arterton seems to drive the film. How do we feel that fits in with the rest of the wartime tone?
Well, it adds a romanticised edge to it, really, doesn't it?
I mean, would you sell the film as something being a romance between those two for people to go and see, or would you sell it as a wartime drama if you were the publicist, if you were the Eddie Marsan of this film?
I wouldn't be selling it as a wartime drama. It's a slightly romantic comedy wartime drama, if we can make a whole new genre out there as such. But, I mean, it wasn't billed as a full-on wartime drama. You knew you weren't going to go and need to get your tissues out, and it would be a really sad experience. And yes, it was a light touch to the war and the Blitz, but it was a good film. And I was also in there with the Blue Rinse Brigade, and they were loving it. And we shouldn't make fun of that, because that was probably their era.
Well, having sat through Going in Style this week, where somebody was laughing so hard I thought it was possibly the most hilarious thing they've ever seen, I actually appreciate people laughing in films where I can see the humour as well, rather than somewhere where I sit just blankly and wonder what on earth's going on. But to come back to their finest, it feels very much like a sense of a feel-good film. We've talked about it clearly appealing to the older generation who may have, in some sense, lived through the war or at least, you know, been close to parents who did. Is there enough here to appeal to the younger generation, you know, the people nearer Sam Claflin and Gemma Arterton's own age?
I would say there is, mostly because of the interaction between the two of them. Also, as I mentioned, Bill Nighy, you can't help but be happy when he turns up on the screen these days, even if he has turned into Bill Nighy playing Bill Nighy more than anything else. He does get a little bit of drama to do in this, in the character that he's cast as in the film, in the role of Uncle Frank. It's nice to see him doing this kind of dual role within a role. It's very, very good. But yeah, coming back to the leads, they, you know, are young enough for me to think, oh, you know, people like me, is this how I would have reacted during the war? Something like that. And, you know, that kept me interested, at least. It's very nice to see the way their relationship is portrayed during the war, which did happen a lot. People from different backgrounds are thrown together because all of the younger men were taken out of the world, essentially. They were shipped somewhere else, and it was like, well, how do we do this now? And they adapted and survived.
Now, I have a personal bugbear in films when a conversation between two characters happens and the first character says, you know about this, don't you? And the second character says, yes. And the first character then proceeds to explain the whole thing anyway for the benefit of the audience. And there is a scene like that very early in this film where Gemma Arterton is being told about how the process of film works. Now, this is something that runs right throughout the film. It's a film that's not only necessarily about the war, but also about film and projection itself and almost that love of film. You know, the scenes which we see from the film that they're making are very lovingly recreated. Did you get a sense of nostalgia from watching those kind of films? Did it make you want to go back and watch lots of classic wartime movies?
It didn't, to be honest, but I did love the aspect of watching the filming of a film. It's not often you get to see that in films nowadays, where, as Dave said earlier, you get to see them playing different characters within, such as Bill Nighy. It was an interesting dynamic to see. I don't feel the need to go and rush off.
You'll not be watching any classic Reach for the Sky or anything else like that from the 50s then, based on this?
Ashamedly, I don't know what Reach for the Sky is.
It's the film where Douglas Bader loses both his legs and gets shot down over.
Sounds like a happy film.
Yes. I'm now panicking. I haven't got the title of that right either. We're going to be getting our Lennon Maltin film encyclopedias out during the next interview, just to brush up on our film titles. And I've now lost the question that I was completely thinking of. Oh, we're going well today, aren't we? I suppose there's a lot of the stereotypes that come in around, you know, it feels very much like it's on rails in terms of its depiction of the war. We go and meet Jeremy Irons at the sort of, you know, war office, and, you know, everyone comes in and talks like this, and you know, I think some of the sense of cliche comes back in there as well. You know, could the film have just been a bit looser for a modern audience?
I don't know, because if it had been looser, the thing is, a lot of the time they were genuinely like that. It was a coping strategy. It's like, you know, if I do let myself go a bit loose, I might, you know, completely break down here. Obviously, Jeremy Irons' character, Secretary of War, I can't see any other way for him to have been portrayed. I was just very annoyed when Winston Churchill didn't show up, pop his head round the door, use the fingers, wave the cigar, and then walk off somewhere else. I mean, possibly that would have been too clichéd, if there is such a thing.
Well, I think we have about 250 different depictions of Churchill coming up in various films this year. I just saw a trailer for the, I think it's the Albert Finney one, Churchill, last night. So, yeah, we'll get our fair share of Churchill this year. I think just to finish off on the film, and I've lost my question again, because I'm talking about Albert Finney. Ridiculous. In fact, I'm going to hold it there and let Toby completely control that when he comes to edit the podcast. Their Finest opened yesterday, which is April the 21st, and is now showing at the Arts Picture House. It's Certificate 12A. While Their Finest throws light on how the wartime necessity of men fighting for their country helped more women move into the film industry, the same is also true behind the scenes at the cinema, especially in the specialised work of the projection booth. Highly technical and labour-intensive, the job of the film projectionist was considered an entirely male preserve, but in order to keep film showing, cinemas had to, reluctantly, hire and train women. To find out more about this little-documented area of cinema history, Bums on Seats host Toby Miller spoke to Rebecca Harrison, lecturer in film and TV at the University of Glasgow. Rebecca revealed how women had to be rushed into a workplace that had been exclusively male. But first, she spoke about what made up the daily routine of the cinema projectionist in the late 1930s.
Projectionist jobs were actually incredibly varied. So I think we tend to think of just one person being in the box projecting a reel of film, or kind of doing a changeover and there being a couple of reels of film on the go. But actually that was, from what we can work out from the records, a really tiny part of their job. They were also responsible for a whole host of other things. So they would be handling and caring for all the films. So that would include splicing all the reels together to make up the film into one, mending the film, any tears or perforations, making sure they were kept clean, because they would often end up with big sort of smudges and fingerprints and so on them. They'd have to rewind them at the end of every show.
so there was this crisis that when war broke out and men were conscripted, that these roles needed to be filled, as many roles did, but they needed to be filled with women. How did the industry sort of deal with that?
Initially, not very well. I think there was a kind of moment of panic in 1939, 1940, when the industry sort of lost its head a bit, as it were. There was a sense that women might be able to take on the role of the projectionist, but it was a really highly skilled position, and it often would take maybe kind of 3 or 4 years of intensive training, with men moving up through the ranks of, you know, third assistant, second, then first projectionist, and then chief. And I think people just didn't know quite how to respond or how to get people into those kind of more senior positions quickly.
Did they put training? I mean, you mentioned training, and obviously these were skilled jobs, as you said, and the men that had been doing them had been years going through the ranks. So there were there crash courses for the women that they needed to go into these roles? Did they put into schools? Did they put up courses? How did they train?
It just stayed localised throughout the entirety of the war. There was never a national programme to sort this out, even though it really was a national crisis. So some of the independent cinemas just kind of kept themselves to themselves, would get women in and create intensive training programmes for them, which sometimes actually sounds quite militaristic and actually a bit mean with hindsight. But then other companies, Gaumont, for example, set up schools which were far more regulated and had proper curriculums, so that women would graduate with a certificate after, you know, 3 months and be able to go and work in practically any projection booth, which seems like a kind of far more measured and sensible response, perhaps.
How did that change the working environment in the cinemas? Were they already in managerial positions, or was it just very much usherettes?
I think mostly it was usherettes that women were working as. Before the war, women were largely confined to the kind of the auditorium, the lobby, and women's bathrooms, and they didn't really have much access to the rest of the cinema. So as soon as women start going into the operator's room, the rewind room, the kind of electrical supply units and spaces, suddenly the whole cinema is being inhabited by women. So I think it was quite a profound change.
Were they working unsupervised? Did they ever move up to, you mentioned the hierarchy of the projection booth. Were they ever trained up the position of chief?
Well, that's actually really interesting, because according to all the official records and all of the material that we found in the trade press, no, they couldn't possibly become a chief projectionist. Slowly throughout the war, as more and more people were being conscripted, women did slowly move up the ladder. So initially they could only qualify as thirds. By the end of the war, they could be first. So that meant they could be alone in the projection box, but a chief projectionist who was a man had to be on site somewhere. However, one of my colleagues, who's a fellow researcher at the University of Warwick, turned up some oral histories of a woman who was working during the Second World War in Coventry. Her name was Florence Barton. And according to her testimony, she actually did qualify as a chief projectionist by the time the war finished. So although the official history says no, it's actually interesting for us to find that there were women that did actually get to the top of the ladder.
And you mentioned the unions earlier, but were they a help and a hindrance? I mean, they must have been resistive, I would have thought, but at the same time, they needed to keep rules and pay equality in place, so when the men came back, as they would have cynically seen it, they weren't coming back to worse jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. The unions played this kind of strange role where there's a tension between their support for the women, and yet they're also consistently saying, the women are here and we need them, but this is a temporary measure for wartime only. As soon as the war's ended, the women will be gone. So for that reason, it was quite easy for them to advocate for women having equal pay, because they didn't want the men to come back and have the women undercutting their wages and being more attractive to the cinemas in terms of keeping them on.
So equal pay was there. It was both a blessing, but also a curse in a way, because it was there to assure that you wouldn't be able to keep, that you could be moved out of position.
Yeah. When I was looking through this history, I was initially thinking, wow, what a great, you know, kind of a feminist moment in the Second World War where the Union say women should have equal pay to men, but of course that wasn't really why they were doing that.
You mentioned the reaction to the cinema industry, but what was the reaction to the sort of paraphernalia around it? Were women in these roles belittled? Were they sexualized in the way that the trade press tends to treat any women moving into new positions?
Oh, absolutely. At the start of the war, particularly, any of the women entering the box were highly sexualized and really demeaned in terms of the work that they were doing. So there would be cartoons of them in these kind of tiny skirts with stockings and high heels, looking entirely inappropriate for the work that they were doing. They would be referred to as girls and as projectionettes. So there was a way in which their title was made other to the men who were the projectionists. So these were, you know, often referred to as like young and silly women who didn't really know what they were doing in the box. However, by the end of the war, when women are also being conscripted and taken off into other kind of nationally vital industries, everyone's tone starts to change slightly and they start to recognize women's importance. So instead of being girls, they become women. They're not so often referred to as projectionettes anymore, and they're starting to be taken more seriously. So you see more pictures of them in their, you know, utilitarian wartime overalls and hard hats.
After the war, and when there was demobilization, I'm presuming, obviously, the cinema industry reverted to type and just hire back the men. Is there any historical evidence of women being kept on or being able to use these skills elsewhere? Because, of course, now they had certificates, they had training.
This is really fascinating because according to the adverts that you see in 1945, 1946, cinemas are starting to advertise for boys and men again rather than girls or women. However, while it seems really likely that lots of women left the profession, especially as, you know, men came back, there were more marriages, women kind of settled back into a more domestic role, perhaps, we've actually found evidence that there's lots and lots of women still working in projection after the war. So again, with fellow researchers at the University of Warwick, we've actually been able to locate some of these women and interview them. And it seems like although there weren't any official figures or statistics or any kind of network linking all these women up, so they often didn't know that one another existed, there were actually quite a few women still hidden away in the box. So I've already mentioned Florence Barton, for example, who carried on working, you know, for decades after the Second World War. And another woman that we spoke to recently, Joan Pearson, who actually didn't even become a projectionist until after the Second World War had ended. So there's a number of these cases, and we think that there are probably even more. These are just anecdotal. And I think it's actually really interesting if you think we don't often see the projectionist because they're concealed. If you see the projectionist, you think they're probably doing their job wrong. But next time you're at the cinema, it's just interesting to think about who actually might be hidden away in the box and the fact that it might be a woman.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Rebecca Harrison for the interview. You can find out more about the history of women working in the early cinema industry by visiting the Projection Project on www.projectionproject.warwick.ac.uk.
I'm Mandy Morton.
And I'm Nicola Robson.
And collectively we present
The Eclectic Light Show,
a monthly arts magazine featuring
the very best in
theatre, music, film, books
and celebrity interviews.
Join us on the first Sunday of every month
from 2 till 4
on community radio
in your city.
Cambridge 105.
Hello, it's Greg here. I'd like to tell you about the Kid for the Cat show, where we play original 78 RPM gramophone records every other Tuesday night between 9 and 11 o'clock at night. And usually have one or two guests in with us as well. So come and join Kipper and me and enjoy the old music here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Hello, I'm Ben Wheatley, the director of Free Fire. This is Bums on Seats.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats, community radio in your city. Still to come, we'll be discussing The Handmaiden and our interview with Woody Harrelson. Whee! But first, we're street racing.
Dominic Toretto just turned on us.
Well, well, well. Do you look at that?
I don't know why he's doing this, but that wasn't Dom.
She's the very definition of high-tech terrorism. And now, she's working with your guy.
I think I found my team.
This should be interesting.
You wanna play like that?
Ouch.
This is impossible.
Which is why you're gonna need a little help.
I will beat you like a Cherokee drum.
We are about to go up like...
Oh, it took longer than I expected.
Now up to its eighth film, the Fast and Furious franchise has long abandoned its roots as a cheap car racing film to become something not unlike James Bond blended with a cannibal run. And while the over-the-top action is easy to mock, the franchise's recurring cast, from Vin Diesel's Dominic Toretto to his team played by Michelle Rodriguez, Tyrese Gibson, Chris Ludacris Bridges and Dwayne Johnson, is easily the most diverse group of action heroes in modern cinema. Picking up where the seventh film left off, Fast and Furious 8 opens with Dominic and Letty newly married and celebrating with a street race in Havana. The honeymoon's quickly over when they have to make a daring raid on a German military base, but after their successful getaway, Dom suddenly turns against his beloved family, running them off the road before vanishing. When the betrayed team reconvene, they discover Dom has sided his considerable muscle with a villain known as Cypher, a cyber terrorist played by Charlize Theron. Dave, Fast and Furious 8 attempts to keep the franchise going after the tragic and untimely death of Paul Walker. Does it still have momentum, or is it now running out of steam?
I'm happy to say it's still as fast-paced and exciting as it always was, and it's now, just as always, ridiculously silly, which is one of the reasons I keep going back and watching them again and again and again. They're just so much fun. They really are. It is a shame. Paul Walker's death, you know, the way they finished the seventh film was a really nice way to cut him out. There's brief mention of his character in this film. Again, we've talked about this earlier. We're not entirely sure why they felt the need to do it, because we effectively know they've excised the character out. And I'm assuming Scott Eastwood has been brought in as almost a replacement. He fits in terms of character, you know, idealistic young law enforcement official turns into street racer. He's got the same taste in cars.
And he's a pretty boy.
And he's a pretty boy as well, yes.
We mentioned the fact that it's a diverse group of heroes. Is it also one that treats its female characters well enough? You've got Michelle Rodriguez, who's come back to the series in the past couple. You've now got a female villainess as well, villain in Charlize Theron, who dominates the parts of the film. And a few other cameos as well, sadly, we can't touch on. Yeah, are actually the female characters getting the same share of the prize as men?
They are, and I love that about this film series. I've seen all eight now, and I love the power they give to Letty, who's Michelle Rodriguez's character. She's not just a little female that sits and watches as her man goes racing. She is in the front of that car doing her own thing. And it's like that in a lot of the films. I think Tokyo Drift as well, which was obviously a earlier one based in Tokyo, loads of the drivers were female, and same in the earlier ons. It's a nice, refreshing thing to have. Don't get me started on Charlize Theron as this villain, though. Why is she in it?
I am entirely going to get you started, because that's why we're here.
First of all, why has she got dreadlocks pretending to be Angelina Jolie in Gone in 60 Seconds? That is all I kept thinking with her.
That's a very good point. I hadn't seen that, but now can't unsee it.
There we go. That was the first thing I thought. As soon as she turns up in Cuba with her dreadlocks and then turns out to be this villain, she's just not believable. And I love these films and I wanted to love it, but her as a villain, she is just not right.
You see, I'm going to bring those two points together, because we're talking about the fact that these are ridiculous fantasies where grown men can actually throw around torpedoes and cars can leap from one building to another in Dubai, as happened in the last film. But when you come to the character moments, they become almost as cartoonish as well. And actually, does it need to ground things a little bit more in that sense?
I think it's the whole fun of the Fast and the Furious, though, isn't it? Nobody would like it if there wasn't cars jumping onto ships and buildings. You've just got to let them run and go with the ridiculousness.
But when it then comes to the character, because what we end up with here, and I found in terms of the energy, the film was great in terms of the first part, although it's a little bit over-edited for my taste in some of the early sequences. But then the film splits in these two directions, and you get Dom off with Charlize Theron, and then everyone else doing the typical Fast and Furious action thing. And without giving too much away about them, the scenes with Dom and Cypher are very serious in terms of the context of the rest of the film. And I just sort of felt the whole energy of the film almost deflate like a balloon the minute those kind of scenes came on screen.
It was a shame. It did kind of spoil the flow of the movie, but at the same time, it was nice to see them trying to do something a little bit different, even if it may have slightly fallen on its face. In the past, when, you know, when they turned into spy movies, essentially, and they confront the villain, it's been banter, let's hit each other with lead pipes. This one was more, you know, you have to talk to me because I'm a proper villain and I've made you turn, you know, away from your friends and family, and you have to deal with this and me. And poor old Vin Diesel, I'm not sure they gave him the lines to deal with it. It's just not really working.
I mean, it's a shame seeing in things like the Triple X franchise, where actually he does get to really enjoy himself, and here, where he's asked to be a bit more serious, and that appears to just result in him delivering things in a steady, slow monotone that has no energy at all. I don't know how much of that was driven by the supposed off-screen tension between him and Dwayne Johnson, and whether that caused them to have less screen time together, but that's been well documented elsewhere, so we won't get too much into it now here. In terms of the progress of the film and the franchise, you know, these things are now going to be never-ending. They've already announced 9 and 10. This is, without giving too much away, maybe a little more open-ended in terms of some of its character stuff. Do you still have the appetite to watch two more of these guaranteed?
I don't know. If they can bring in, bring in a wider cast, I'm not sure how it could get much wider already. They seem to have cast everyone I know from modern film in this one. And maybe up the ante a bit in the villains. Charlize Theron, she was all right, but like I said, because she was a different type of villain, it didn't quite work as well in terms of, you know, what we're used to, perhaps. I like the idea that her villain is kind of like the villain who's overseeing the villains. So maybe if we can get more of those exciting sub-villains in as well and have them all, you know, mash up together, it could work. Otherwise, you know, even Splody Splody Submarine will not be enough for me.
I suppose my biggest worry about the future of the franchise is when you look at the main theme running through the film, it's talking about family. And it's weird that it's a film series that has a very odd sense of family. I suppose, you know, it's deconstructing the nuclear family, but it's very much still trying to define what family is. And if you played a drinking game with this film and had a sip every time they said the word family, I doubt you'd be able to walk out the screening at the end. Has it gone as far as it can with those kind of themes now?
No, I think that's the nice touch with the films, with all of the car scenes and the explosions. I think it's quite a nice way that at the end of most films, they come together as a family, and that's why they're always there and fighting for each other. It would be it'd be different if they didn't have that anymore. I want the same people back in the next film. Hopefully not Charlize Theron, who knows. But I want the actual family back together, for sure.
There are rumours of there being a spin-off in between the next two films as well, which would feature Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Jason Statham in a sort of buddy comedy. For me, Jason Statham is the most valuable player in this. He gets a little hard-boiled homage at one point with a scene with a baby on a plane and steals almost every scene he wanders into. Everyone else love the Stath as much as I do?
Yeah, he is probably my favourite character in the entire film, apart from something that I'm not allowed to mention, so I'm not going to.
He had a brilliant scene with a certain cameo appearance lady who we're not going to give away. And he's brilliant. You can't not love Jason Statham. And the scene where he's holding a baby and stopping it being shot, it's just hilarious.
Yeah, regularly turning to just have a chat with the baby in the middle of an action sequence. I think the love for this is clear, but it's on very particular terms. And so it's a good place to say that Fast and the Furious 8 opened last week and is now showing at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. And thanks to one cut from the studio, it's managed to scrape a certificate 12A.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Earlier this year, the actor Woody Harrelson made his debut as a director with the wonderfully ambitious Lost in London, a comedy based around a night in 2002 when Harrelson was arrested after a brief chase by the police. Lost in London was a feature film shown to audiences as it was made. Shot in one continuous 90-minute take, so no edits to cover mistakes, on the streets of London at 2 a.m. The film was simultaneously broadcast to over 500 cinemas in the USA and three picture houses in London. This Sunday, there's a chance to see Lost in London again, this time at the more hospitable time of 3 p.m. as the Arts Picture House has a one-off screening. The film is then followed by a Q&A with the man himself, Woody Harrelson. To help preview the special screening, regular Bums on Seats host Ashley Capaldi was lucky enough to talk to Woody Harrelson about the technical difficulties of a one-take film and the strong influence of the German thriller Victoria. But first he spoke about why he'd chosen such an ambitious technique for the film.
I think that's true, that statement. Happy wife, happy life.
Yeah.
Is there something you're not telling me?
No, just...
Oh, yeah, lovely, lovely, mate.
Oh, my God. You're fine. Maybe she hasn't even seen it.
Well, that's true. I mean, maybe she hadn't seen it.
I didn't know that I was going to make it this hard for myself, but I did, because I wrote another screenplay, too, and I was thinking I might do that one first, but then I thought, well, I think being, I know I could do this if I, the other one is a little more complicated, and I thought, this one I could actually shoot in real time, and that'll be, you know, in a sense, blending theater and film. And in this case, it's 99 minutes long. And then I realized, well, you know, if you're going to have a theater part of it, there needs to be a live audience. And so then that's when I got the idea of trying to live stream it into cinemas as we shot it, which was probably... just actually an idiotic idea. I can't tell you, maybe 1,000 times I wished I hadn't had that idea. But in the end, it came out pretty good, so I'm glad I did it.
I was wondering if your thought process was to go big or go home with your first time, or if you'd had this idea but you just couldn't find another director crazy enough to do it for you.
No, it wasn't about going big or going home. It just kind of developed, you know. Like, at first it was just about doing essentially what Victoria or, you know, Russian Ark did, you know.
That was my favorite film of that year, Victoria.
Oh, isn't it great? I love that movie, you know. And, I mean, I had this idea to do it in real time actually a long time before the technology existed. And then when I heard about Victoria, I was like, oh, someone already did it.
They took four takes for Victoria, so you did it in one.
Yeah, well, we shot two the night before. We shot it twice, so we could have used one of those, but I wanted to use the live take.
Do you think you'd ever do something as nuts as this again? Or are you going to treat the other screenplay you've got written and ready a little differently? Do you want to do something completely different next time, or are you interested in thinking out of the box and pushing cinema to different places? Is that what you're going to be as a director, do you think?
No, I don't think I would try to do this again. I mean, I might if there were, you know, the 14 locations and covering, like, you know, 2 mile radius. I think it was, there was just too many technical things that nearly destroyed it, and very, very nearly, just like the sound especially was the main thing that just came together like the last minute. I mean, right up to the last minute, I thought, this is a disaster.
150 microphones I read that you had. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. It was, yeah, there was, oh man, it was out of control. It was 160 radios, but it was 35 people mic'd. And then, you know, all these different signals, it was very hard for the, you know, for the sound. There was just, I think, like, I don't know, 26 people in the sound department alone, you know, 300 people in the crew. Yeah, it was intense, man. And you know, I'd like to say it was fun, but I was stressing too much to say it was fun.
Dude,
it's just really sad.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a mangy dog that no one wants to pet.
I'm your friend. I'm going to support you, but how do you support a scumbag? That's our challenge. I mean, obviously, it's not about me right now, but...
How did your cast come together? Because it's a mess trying to get everyone's schedules together anyway. Were some of the people you were interested in completely turned off by the lunacy of what you were trying to do, were they too scared to get involved, or did you get everyone you asked for?
Owen Wilson, who, you know, is one of my best buddies, I wanted him to do it. It actually was important to have him in it because the guy who wasn't there on the night, but the people who were there was like Leo DiCaprio and some other people. I just couldn't figure out how to write that funny, so I started writing. I figured I might as well write my buddy, and I started writing Owen, and it started getting funnier. And then I think if Owen would have said no, it would have been hard. But then not only was he in, because at one point I said, you know what, the difficulties were just insurmountable, and I was like, we're not going to do it live. And he says, really? Because I thought that was a cool idea, man. And I said, really? And he says, yeah. And so then I just kept pressing on the live thing, and then it did come together after all. And then Willie Nelson, I called Owen just to talk to him about something. I forget. And he says, I'm here with Willie. Willie gets on. Hey, man. And I said, Willie, how you doing, buddy? He says, well, so how come you didn't ask me to be in your movie? And I said, do you really want to be in it? And I was like, okay, I'll write you in. So I did. I wrote him in it. And so glad he came over to do it.
And just to go back to Victoria, I don't know about you, but when I was, I happened to know that it was shot in one take before I saw it, but I kept forgetting all the way through because it's so seamless and you completely forget until you see these brilliant feats of the poor cameraman. So are you hoping people forget that you've shot this in one take as well, or do you want them to feel the haphazardness and the stress and the breathlessness you all went through on the night?
Well, I put a prologue, 3.5-minute prologue, just to give people the sense of, you know, what we were going through and try to put them in that mindset of the night. But in terms of just the single camera thing, it's not that big a deal to me that people are cognizant of it. I'm just happy that people do tend to forget it as they're watching it, you know. And by the way, you know, Nigel Willoughby, the DP, was absolutely right. Like that was how we had to shoot it. I can't imagine it with cuts all through it. I think it would have broken the narrative, you know, or broken the the audience's perception of the film. So, yeah, it's not that big a deal, but, it is a big deal. Of course, to be able to pull that off was quite a big deal. But, yeah, it was just stupidity. But, I'm just happy if people like it as a story, like the story, you know.
Sometimes you want to go wherever.
Stop making noise there. Just go to the back of that line and you daft twat.
I definitely, absolutely can't let you go. Everyone I've told that I'm talking to you wants to know, are you doing Zombieland 2?
Yeah, well, we have been definitely in talks about it, about Zombieland 2. I think it'll probably happen, and it won't be this year, but we'll probably shoot it next year. So that, but I'm, you know, you never know. It depends. The screenplay has to be great because if we're going to make it, we don't want to make it be anything but at least as good as the last one and hopefully better.
Yeah. Are you able to say anything about what the other screenplay you've got in your back pocket's about, or is that another surprise?
Well, I'll just say it takes place entirely in Ireland and it's called The Misadventures of Mr. Fitz.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many, many thanks to Woody Harrelson for finding time for the interview. And special thanks to Soleil Zuinich, Lev Wattak in London and Jack Toy at the Arts Picture House for making the interview happen. And apologies to any of you listening if I've mispronounced your names. Lost from London with that post-screening Q&A with Woody Harrelson is this Sunday. So tomorrow, if you're listening to us live, at 3 p.m.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
His 2014 hit The Lunchbox demonstrated that Mumbai-born filmmaker Ritesh Batra had a talent for meditative and unfussy drama. His interest in film as a slow reveal makes Batra seem the ideal director for the adaptation of Julian Barnes' Man Booker Prize-winning novel The Sense of an Ending. Like the book, The Sense of an Ending shifts its story between two time periods, the present day and the 1960s. Jim Broadbent plays Tony Webster, a retired doctor who is surprised when a former girlfriend's mother leaves him a diary in her will. This surprise bequest revives long-suppressed memories of university life, of a first love, of a friend's betrayal, and of a terrible, unnecessary revenge.
Dear Tony, I think it right that you should have the attached, and perhaps you'll find it an interesting, if painful, memento of long ago.
Mrs. Ford's will describes the item as a diary.
A diary?
It's currently with Mrs. Ford's daughter.
Veronica.
Hello.
Hello, Anthony.
Veronica and I were together.
Boyfriend, girlfriend?
Exactly, yeah.
Then in my school days,
I met my best friend.
Tony Webster.
I'm Adrian Finn.
Not long after, Veronica formed a relationship with him. And I wrote them both a very nasty letter.
What you end up remembering isn't always what you actually witnessed.
It was an accident.
Legally, yes. Morally, no.
So what were you doing there?
Dave, The Sense of an Ending discusses notions of truth and memory, but will it linger long in your memory?
I'm not sure if it will or not. I mean, in terms of what I went to see, it was definitely value for money. Jim Broadbent is absolutely fantastic. I mean, the trouble with Jim Broadbent, I suppose, is that he's always absolutely fantastic, and you can't deny him that. And the rest of the cast did very well too, but it was the story itself I had trouble engaging with, especially at the start. I mean, we were discussing it earlier, and the way it was being drip-fed in was almost a bit too slow. There's a difference between the book that it's based on and the film itself in terms of the narrative. The book kind of goes in a more chronological order and keeps it all flowing along quite nicely, whereas the film makes use of keeping in the present time and then using the past as flashbacks. And, you know, they come in at different time periods in the flashback as well, so you don't always have a linear progression, which kind of makes it a bit tricky to follow, and you might lose track of where you're going or what they were aiming for.
I said that for me was probably the biggest problem, because we're reliant on Jim Broadbent's character to then tell us when we're going to get information, and he's a very uptight, almost reclusive character in terms of his emotions and his personality at the beginning, so consequently it takes us half an hour or so to get anything useful to hang off the characters. So I really missed a sense of a beginning to this film. It just took a little too long to get going. When it does, it seems to throw in lots of great characters. My biggest regret is that Charlotte Rampling didn't get more screen time.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, again, it's almost, she is in herself one of the best actresses in the world. And, you know, when she turned up, it's in, as you said, she's playing his lost young love, come back now to, she's in part, I don't know if she's intentionally drawing him back into her life. She says it's not her intention, but it was one of the things that I did wonder about the film, is like, if that wasn't your intention, why would you take this step of withholding this thing that has been requested to him in the will? And because if you've known this person before, you know that their character is going to have them, you know, come and hunt you down effectively. It's actually some of the moments of levity in the second half of the film where his character did open up a bit more with some of my favourite part, and that did almost relate directly to reintroducing Charlotte Rampling's character as she was, or as she is now in the current time. And there's discussions with his ex-wife, with his daughter, and he's finally opening up to them a bit, and they see this change in character as well, and it does improve the film, in my opinion.
I was sorry to hear about your mother, Veronica.
Yes.
As you're no doubt aware, it appears that your mother left something to me in her will. And when I spoke with your mother's solicitor, I was told that the item that has been left to me was a diary written by Adrian.
I don't have the diary.
Excuse me?
I burnt it.
But it belongs to me. At least have the right to know what is in it.
Legally, yes. Morally, no.
Yeah, in terms of the way that that film is structured, I wondered about the necessity of some of these supporting characters, in particular the daughter, who I never really was convinced that the film needed that character there. You get a lot of great stuff with Harriet Walter playing his ex-wife in terms of their relationship there, but I'm not quite sure what then the relationship with the daughter added on top of that.
I wasn't sure until there's a moment near the end of the film. His daughter is played by Michelle Dockery. She's heavily pregnant in the film, and at one point they're called out on a false alarm, and then the second time they're called out because she's going to give birth to his grandson, I think, for the first time. And it's while he's there with her in the hospital, she is the person to realise that something has disturbed him so much, but she is also the person who gets him to actually talk about it for once. And I think that was possibly the purpose of her character there, is because he's, throughout the film, there's little accusations of his selfish nature and things like that. You know, he is in a hospital with his daughter about to give birth and is not thinking of her, as his ex-wife points out. And then she, at this point, kind of turns it around and realises, you know, I'm about to give birth, this is actually happening, but hold on, there is something has deeply upset my father here. And, you know, she turns the situation on its head, and I think that's actually a good thing for her character to have been there to done that, because otherwise the movie might have dipped back into that kind of slow drip feed that wasn't really working in the first half. It almost is a film of two halves, where you're getting a slow setup, and then as the information comes in, it finally almost kicks into a pace that's, you know, telling a better story, I think.
Is the risk of the information coming too quickly then towards the end? Because there were certain points when I had to almost step back from the film a moment and think, what have I just been told here? What's actually happening? Because of some of those muddled perspectives occasionally, particularly this big reveal, which we won't spill here.
Yes, and again, that's where they used a jumble of flashbacks to kind of represent what was going on. I have to admit, the reveal came, I thought I knew what it was, and I clearly didn't because I misinterpreted it entirely. But then there's a kind of a slow summary piece at the end where he's reading a letter again. The film opens and closes with him reading, it could be the same letter, I'm not entirely sure. And it kind of re-evaluates everything again. And that's a lot of the theme of the movie, seems to be a re-evaluation of life and how you remember it. And that is actually particularly well done when it flashes back to the time when he writes another letter, and you see him write the letter, and then later on in the film, due to another reveal about the situation and what actually happened, you see him write the letter again, and you realise what a trick memory has played on him.
Is there a sense of a slight missed opportunity here? Because I love films which play with that idea of memory and those changing perspectives. I certainly tried, I think, to draw a lot of that out of the novel, but some of that just feels a little bit too muddled towards the end.
Yeah, I think missed opportunity is the best way to sum it. Almost like, you know, maybe our own memories could have been suffering from some need for a reevaluation when we were watching it. As I said, that reveal that was more confusing because we couldn't quite follow it as well. I've not got this far in the book, so I don't know if the same thing happens or, you know, how it's told. But that would be the bit where, if they'd done it properly, that would have elevated the film a bit more, given it a higher level. But that was the stumble that makes it miss out a bit, I think.
The one other thing that was just struck me about the film at certain points is there's a sort of meticulousness, and I saw this as well in Richard Spatra's previous film, The Lunchbox, which made me desperately want to eat lots of Indian food. There's lots of tiny details, and it felt like I was trying to be told something by those details. For example, at one point, it spent a lot of time watching Jim Brown put stamps on either envelopes or cards, and it's lots of little tiny details in the way things work. He's got a background as a sort of camera shop as well, which he's sort of picked up through the process of life. To me, it just felt a lot of these tiny details are adding a bit of texture, but it's almost the classic shot in the woodland of blowing trees. They don't ultimately do anything but add unnecessary texture.
There was the stamp moment is actually one that I remember sticking with me while I was watching the film. I'm glad you reminded me about it because of my own memory clearly needing a few faults and evaluations.
Or was it actually in there at all? Have I played with your memory?
It was in there twice, in fact. You see him put the stamp on an envelope in the past, and then you see him do the same thing at least two more times in the present day. And what I noticed was, and this is an infuriating level of detail, is his method between the sending in the past and the first one that he sends back is exactly the same. But then when he resends another letter in the future, this is when, after all the reveals have been made, we're getting near the end of the film and his character has changed and he goes about it in an entirely different way. And I was just like, ah, that is very clever, you know, showing how this small change has affected him in the way he just affects his own mannerisms. And I thought that bit was particularly clever. But I did like the way it also showed, you know, throughout our lives, you know, we're not always capable of change until something occurs to make it happen to us. And that just putting stamps on envelopes showed it happening to him.
I don't want to give away too much about the ending, particularly for people like yourself who have maybe still reading the book or haven't seen the film. But it was a weird combination for me of a film which ties a lot up in neat bows, and they feel a lot of very packed character resolutions, but at the same time, it also likes to leave a few things open and hanging empty. Is it truly satisfying?
I'm not entirely sure. And it really irked me as I was walking out the cinema, because a lot of people who were in there with me at the same time, it was quite a small crowd because it was Friday early afternoon, and they were all just going, oh, yes, that was very good. Oh, yes. But no one could seem to say why it was very good. And I think this might tie into it. They all, you know, they all felt that it was well portrayed. I thought it was well portrayed as well. But when you actually sit back and look at the ending again, it's like, well, they did resolve that bit, but they've left this entire bit open entirely. I mean, maybe it, because it's based on the book, maybe this is the author's way of commentating on life, is that there is no neat resolution. We can't expect, especially in a situation as the one that's being discussed in the film, there is never going to be a neat resolution there to be had. So, you know, it ties up some things, it leaves the other things open, and it does make you think about it, search and question them. And I guess, you know, if you're going to call the film a sense of an ending, then maybe that's the best way to close it, you know, leave some things closed, but make the others feel like there might be more to them.
Well, if you have a sense that you've maybe seen this before, or maybe haven't, or aren't sure, you can still catch this at the Arts Picture House. It's a Certificate 15. Based on the 2002 novel Fingersmith, but swapping that book's corseted Victorian setting for the opulence and oppression of Japanese-occupied 30s Korea, new release The Handmaiden is a labyrinthian tale of duplicity and erotic intrigue. Kim Tae-ri stars as Suk-hee, a con artist from a long family line of con artists. She is enlisted by the ambitious Count Fujiwara to work in the household of the Lady Hidoro, whose hand he wishes to win in marriage. The Count's scheme is for the slow and steady drip of Suk-hee's praise to win over the reluctant heiress, but this plan merely hides another, more devious intention. Yozi, The Handmaiden is a return to Korean filmmaking after Chan-wook Park's Stoker in 2013. Does the film justify taking Sarah Waters' novel to a Korean setting?
Yes, I think it does. I think the key themes that you find in the novel Fingersmith, which are sort of female empowerment, class, oppression, that kind of thing, are translated really well to this story. And actually, as somebody who knew the story of Fingersmith and did not know that The Handmaiden was based on Fingersmith, I think I had quite an interesting take on it, because I sat there, you know, watching the film thinking, oh, this is great. Oh, wait a second, I know what happens. Why do I know what happens? Where's this story from? And then I realised, of course, it's from Fingersmith. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, for me, in terms of the filmmaking and the way the story was told, I think it was very well done, and it didn't detract that I already knew all the twists and turns that the film had. That didn't detract and take anything away from the film, which I thought was really, really good.
And it's a strange experience sometimes, you know, if you watch a film that has well-publicised twists and turns, you know, if you were to watch a Sixth Sense or a Usual Suspects these days, when pretty much everyone knows the twists whether you've seen it or not, you know, when a film is built so much on those twists and turns, is the film as such built on those twists in this case, or is there more going on?
I think there's a lot beneath the surface. I think the twists and turns are quite a fun addition to the film. And, you know, I don't know, it's quite hard because I already knew the twists and turns. I don't know how much they would add for somebody that didn't know the story beforehand. But there's a lot going on underneath. I mean, just in terms of like the display on the screen, how it looks, you know, the actual story, the way it's all dealt with. There are some really great scenes. There's just really good performances. There's a really good, it's like sinister feel throughout. There's lots coming in with from lots of different angles that mean the twists and turns is just part of it. I don't think it necessarily, it's not the whole film.
I mean, the film itself first showed at Cannes last year, I think, and actually won an award there for art direction. It is a sumptuous-looking film. Is it style over substance at certain points?
No, I didn't think it was. I really loved... I mean, I think, actually, it's one of the best film subtitled films I've seen in a long time. And I thought it was really beautifully shot. And I was someone who hadn't read the Fingersmith book, and I purposely didn't look up too much information about what this film was about when I went to see it. And I was just so pleasantly surprised. And the twists and turns, it would still, in my mind, be just as good if it didn't have them. But I didn't see them coming at the same time. So it was a nice added extra. And the way it was shot, it was, I mean, there's some quite full-on intimate scenes in it. But at no point do you think that's vulgar or crude. It's too much. And I think that's because of the style of how it is shot and the story, that it doesn't turn it into something else. I didn't feel like uncomfortable sat watching it. And I think that's all credit to how it was filmed.
I have to say, when I saw this for the second time this week, I saw the extended version. There were two walkouts at the screening I was at. One person left during the main sex scene in the middle of the film, and one person left more towards the end when there's a particularly gory scene, which we won't give too much away. It is an 18 rating, so anyone going should be prepared for that. We have a particular reaction, I think, to some of these kind of things. You know, particularly seeing sex scenes on screen. I've seen a number of films this year, including Aquarius as well, where all of a sudden people go, "Ooh, we're seeing something silly on the screen." It must be difficult for someone like Chan-Wook Park to approach that, and in particular the fact that he closed the set, I understand, so he was the only man on set that day when the female sex scenes were being filmed. What does that mean in terms of the gaze of the film, the male-female perspectives?
I think the sex scenes are a really interesting point. I think what he does very well with the sex scenes is that he takes something that could traditionally be towards the male gaze, and it does kind of start out like that when the sex scenes start, but I feel like it's completely turned on its head, and I like the way that he does play with that and change the gaze so that the two lead characters they take the male gaze and kind of just revert it, like they totally turn it on its head, and that's really, really clever. And I feel like if people are turned off by those sex scenes, then they kind of need to grow a pair, because I thought they were great.
It helps the characters develop,
it's really part of the whole...
It made you see how they came together and where it went on from there and why they were like that.
And you don't see lesbian sex scenes played like that in cinema normally. Really well done, really thought out. Still really natural, but without making it too much of a spectacle so that it is specifically for the male gaze. Like, you don't see that a lot in cinema, and I really appreciated how he did that and took that and made it quite a key part of the film, to be honest.
Absolutely.
It's not just necessarily about the sex scenes that we see. There are scenes where one of the characters is reading to a group of men sat in the room, and the whole film has this sort of charge to it. And so even the most simple scenes, like putting on a piece of clothing, Chan-Wook Park, I think, has tried to elevate those scenes and to really use that to build the tension. You know, in terms of, you know, even the costume, the dressing, things like that, does it all bind together well in the film?
It does. And I mean, the costumes are beautiful. And maybe that's partly why they moved it to a Korean setting as well. So they could touch upon that era and how the women were and dressed. I don't know. But it was brilliant. And the way they even used clothes and jewellery as a way to try and gain their trust in the characters. And I just loved it. Other than this scene at the end where you said someone walked out in a torture scene. It wasn't the torture scene that put me off. It was how suddenly this crazy uncle, how he turned out to be and the things he was saying, I thought maybe that wasn't quite needed.
I mean, it is, even if, because it's been released in two versions, people in Korea demanded to see more of the film, so they were put an extra 22 minutes in. It wasn't a director choice. He was appealing to his public. But even the shorter version is 2 hours, 24 minutes. And, yeah, we mentioned in my introduction the steady drip of information. You know, it's a film which takes its time, leisurely paced. Does that sense of pacing work well in creating the atmosphere and creating the story?
I think so, and I think why the pacing is the way it is I think it's because of the characterization, which for me was the real key thing in the film. It takes time to build these characters and to understand them and their motives, especially in a film like The Handmaiden, where you've got these twists, you've got these turns, you're hearing it from different perspectives. You need to really get what's going on in these characters' heads, and I feel like the pace and the way it's explored makes it a real experience. You come to really root for, especially, you know, the two leads, you come to really root for them. And I don't think you would root for them as easily if the characterization hadn't been developed so well. Because at one point, one person looks like the bad guy, at another point, another person looks like the bad guy. Do you know what I mean? It's easy to not really understand what's going on, but I felt like it was done really well.
In the extended version of the film, the subtitles are all in white, but in the version that I saw, and I think the one that you saw as well, in the standard version, the Korean and Japanese subtitles are in different colours to differentiate the languages. How much does that help or hinder our understanding of the setting of the film in that Japanese-occupied Korea?
I think it helped, to be honest. I think what it did, having, I think, the Japanese subtitles were in yellow and the Korean subtitles were in white. I think it added to making the audience aware, for example, of how Suk-hee, who is the Korean character, is trying to fit in with this, you know, in this Japanese world that she's placed in. And I think having the subtitles there helped to kind of understand that more. Not to say that, you know, having all the same colour subtitles, it wasn't obvious, but I quite liked it, and I am a linguist, so I would quite like it, but I did like having that dimension, so I knew more about what Suk-hee was feeling, or, you know, that kind of thing, and how she had to fit in and the extra steps she had to take.
I mean, it's interesting for me because I also managed to catch The Age of Shadows, which was the Korean film which got nominated for the Academy Awards Foreign Language Film over The Handmaiden this year, and that's also set in Korean-occupied Japan in the 30s, but that's more like a sort of World War II resistance-type movie in the sense that that runs through. This is very much adding background and context to the situation without ever really coming to the foreground. Could this film have almost been set anywhere? You know, could we see a modern day version of this story at some point?
I guess we could, but I feel like it wouldn't be as special if they were to do that. And I think with the modern day films, obviously we haven't seen anything exactly like it, but there's similar things modern day, and I think it makes it so special that it is based in another country and that it's set in the, was it the 30s?
Yeah, in the 30s.
Yeah, it just puts a different twist on it. If it was modern, I don't feel it would be as beautiful. No.
And does that sense of beauty come from the clashing of the cultures? Because we not only have the Japanese and the Korean influences, but also a lot of the setting is a sort of English-style country house, which is, you know, it's a sort of mix of styles, and you get a lot of that strange sense. It's not like watching a typical Japanese or Korean film in that sense.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it looks like they're in an English manor at times, and then from the dress and the costumes and the jewellery, they bring in the Asian influence in it more.
I mean, it's sumptuous. It's a really sumptuous film to look at. It's beautiful. And yes, you know, the house does look like an English manor house, but the sense of culture really is there. And I just kind of want to go back to your point on the sort of cultural commentary, social commentary. I have to say, I don't really know a lot about, you know, Korean-occupied Japan in the 1930s. So from that perspective, it is quite nice to have the film set there so that you can get a sense of that time and what was going on. Because, I mean, you're right, the film could be set at any point, in any time. I mean, Fingersmith itself is from Victorian London. And I actually think part of the strength of the film is taking that and moving it from Victorian London right out to Japan. And it gives it more to its credit, really.
I have to say that I have a soft spot for any kind of film which deals with the power of characters in some sense of unreliable narrators as well, and there's a lot of those kind of things going on here. There's a certain shift in the power dynamic between the characters. Some of that relates to the gender we talked about. Some of that also relates to their sexuality as well. Did you really get a sense of the characters' motivations at various points in the film?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some of the tools that Park Chan-wook used to portray that were quite clever. I mean, I did like how specific scenes are obviously played two or three times throughout the film, each time with a different perspective behind it. And just the little things that he'd throw in there you'd be watching the scene again, but there'd be like another dynamic to it, or there'd be a different, I don't know, completely different understanding, which does help you get the motivations of the characters. I do think it takes a while to get there, obviously because of the unreliable narrator, and you do kind of have to see that same sequence three times to fully understand what are these characters doing, like who are they trying to trick here, kind of thing. But I don't think that's a negative thing.
I have to say, in terms of talking to people about the fact I'm going to see a Korean film if I go to the cinema, people have got this expectation of what a Korean film's become these days, because it's the likes of Old Boy, one of Park Chan-wook's previous films, and so on, which brought Korean cinema to a little more prominence amongst the mainstream in this country. Does this start to get away from that stereotype enough that hopefully people are open to more Korean films of different natures? Does it feel like a sort of what you would expect if someone said, go and watch a Korean film, and then you were presented with this? Does it meet that expectation?
I have not seen a lot of Korean cinema, to be honest, so I can't comment on behalf of everyone on that.
Would it tempt you to see more on this basis?
It would. It absolutely would. I did not think I was going to enjoy this film at all, and I like some subtitle films, but it's never something I would choose to go to first, and I feel like I'm converted now. Like, I would definitely give subtitled films a much larger shot, and I want to see more Korean films as well. It was brilliant. If they're all like that, bring it on.
Yossi?
I mean, I agree totally. I think it's, if you've seen a lot of Korean cinema in the past, I mean, I haven't seen loads, but I've seen a bit, and I think it's still, I mean, I love Korean cinema, so I think it's still, you know, really good, and it's got that sort of high quality. But as an introduction to Korean cinema, it also works really, really well. And yeah, I love it. And can I just add, I think it is also a really great exploration of female empowerment, which I thought was just, yeah, brilliant. As you can see, I loved it.
I mean, it's a film which takes time to build its characters, and that perspective of the film changes over the course of time, doesn't it? Where the male characters are probably the more dominant at the start of the film, and then gradually we see that shift.
And again, that relates to the sex scenes, about taking something that's quite male and inverting it and making it more about female empowerment and female gaze. And I just think that all adds up to this amazingness.
That feels like a nice place to leave that as well. The Handmaiden opened last week and is now showing at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 18. That's all we have time for on the show today, but it's just worth mentioning, while we're talking about Korean cinema, that there is a showing on Monday at the Arts Picture House of Missing, which is the second in the series of Korean films, which are teasers at the Korean Film Festival. So if we've sold you on the idea of Korean cinema, then hopefully you'll go and give this a try. And it's worth saying that it's only £5 if you're a member of the Arts Picture House. That's showing at 6:30 on Monday, and do keep an eye out for further Korean cinema coming soon. The Last Hour will be repeated this coming Monday at 11 p.m, while an iTunes podcast with longer edits of the interviews, plus a review of The Sense of an Ending, which Dave and I will be talking about shortly, will be available on Tuesday. To find us and then subscribe to us on iTunes or other podcast channels, just search for Bums on Seats. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, just search for Bums on Seats. We'll be back on a fortnight's time on May the 6th. Up for debate on that particular show are reviews of Guardians of the Galaxy 2, also the silliness of Julian Barrett's Mindhorn, Jamie Foxx in the thriller Sleepless, and on a much more serious note, we'll also have Lady Macbeth, starring Florence Pugh as the young bride who discovers a freedom in immorality. Well, thank you for listening, and from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
We're just two little girls from Little Rock. We lived on the wrong side of the tracks. But the gentlemen friends who used to call, they never did seem to
So I up and left the pieces there. Like a little lost lamb I roamed about. I came to New York and I found out that men are the same way everywhere. I was young.